Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with theater's biggest names. This episode is a continuation of the September Beetlejuice Takeover. It's a little two-part bonus episode that I'm sneaking into October because, well, it's Beetlejuice and it's a show about death and Halloween's coming up, so why not? This is part one with Elliot Maddox, Ramon Owens, and Dana Steingold, who are all ensemble members in the show. And this is now actually my second ensemble-focused episode, the first one being from the prom takeover back in May. And I just absolutely love the energy and the feeling of family that the ensemble, that this many people bring together. They've been through so much, and they're telling stories about each other and recalling memories together. And as one person says something, the other's eyes light up as they're remembering it. It's just, it's so much fun to sit here quietly and actually watch them all talk to each other during this interview. So it's really a pleasure to be a part of. And I just want to emphasize again how difficult ensemble members have it in the business in terms of having to memorize multiple roles and multiple tracks and do all these costume changes. And then we got into this a little bit specifically because of sort of the mixed reviews that came out of the DC out-of-town tryout. But having that many people who have to know that many tracks and do that many roles, all having to change and learn multiple things. They're rehearsing for version A in the afternoon, performing version B in the evening, and then maybe teching version C the next day. It's incredible the amount of knowledge that these people have stored in their brains. It's just an incredible interview, and part two gets into National Coming Out Day, because that was a couple days ago in the timeline of when we record this. They all have some great stories and some great advice, even recounting their own coming out, which was just incredible. So before we get into part one here, I want to mention Cheryl Hodges Selden, who, if you're listening, hi, Cheryl. She was the latest patron to support at the $30 tier, which, of course, gets her mentioned in the shout out here. And she also got some swag that I sent her from the Broadway Flea Market and a couple other benefits, of course, that you can see by visiting ttp.fm/Patreon. Finally, please visit BroadwayPodcastNetwork.com to find me and many other amazing podcasts. And now please enjoy part one of this bonus episode with Elliot Maddox, Ramon Owens, and Dana Steingold.
Here you go. One, two, three.
Welcome to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with theater's biggest names. This episode is actually a special bonus episode continuing September's Beetlejuice Takeover, and I have the pleasure of talking to three of the amazing ensemble members from the show, Elliot Maddox, Ramon Owens, and Dana Steingold. Welcome to the Theater Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Dana, did I say that? Steingold or Steingold?
Steingold. You were right.
Cool. All right, so you guys are all part of the amazing ensemble that makes up this amazing show that is Beetlejuice. How many different roles do you all play?
I think I have eight or nine costume changes, but I think some of them are the same costume. Yeah. So like seven, eight different characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
About seven, eight different characters, maybe costumes, about four or five characters. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I basically just play the Girl Scout, but then I'm inside of a lot of boxes puppeteering throughout the rest of the show.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. Yeah. The puppeteering. So yeah. they get ensemble. Do you have puppeteering experience?
I do. I did Avenue Q for a year and a half.
Oh,
so,
right.
Yeah, and I think it sort of came into play in development, and they thought like, oh, we could bring in puppets, and who might know how to use puppets? And then the second to last lab, Michael Curry, said, hey, Dana, are you claustrophobic? And I said, no. And he was like, cool, come with me to the other room. And he was like, this is the box we're going to put you in.
So, yes. Are you allowed to say what puppet you do?
Yeah, I do the shrunken head and I do the pig in the dinner party.
Wait, the shrunken head, I thought that was on top of a person. Is there
It is, but it is
puppeted.
It's a puppet. It's like almost like football gear that sits on my shoulders and then it attaches to my head and I operate all the movements. And then my lower half is obviously the remaining portion.
You've just blown my mind. Okay. And so you mentioned you're the Girl Scout. Is that one of your favorite roles?
well, it's my only role in this play. So. But yeah, no, it's been like kind of a dream to create something. And I think it's really rare that you get to go from like the very first reading and you think you're doing something right and you know, you hope. And then you get to see it all the way through to Broadway. That's, I think, pretty rare. So there's a handful of us. There's five of us who've been here since the first reading, I think. And that's been really, really fun.
Ellie and Ramon, have you guys been from the first reading or when did you get involved?
I was involved from the first lab. So from the first lab, like 2 years ago, I've been with the show since then. So I came on later. I'm the only person that came on at the lab and has been on, and been there through. So that's been a really cool experience too. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Ramon?
Yeah, and I joined for the DC out of town tryout last August.
Oh, so you've been pretty recent.
Yeah. I'm pretty new to the experience.
Were they adding ensemble as they went, or were there people that just didn't travel from the reading to the lab to DC and all that?
It was more the second scenario.
Yeah, a little of both. I think they were sort of figuring out, as you do in development, coverage and who had to be an internal cover and what track would have to, you know, puppeteer, et cetera, and like who would be, how many vocal parts you need. So I think that sort of shifted, but I think it was a little of both.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. I guess coming from the corporate background that I've got, I always think of like, it's so hard to get headcount and so hard to get extra staffing and grow your team. But it's like when you're putting together a show, it's just something completely different of like, oh, well, that she's literally going to be put in a box. Mm-hmm. She can't make it out of her shrunken head in time to get over there. All right, let's hire one. Let's
go. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and now something that is like kind of cool, if you think about like the legacy of theater, like, for however long Beetlejuice runs, let's say 20 years is reasonable. Like, Dana's track will forever be based on Dana's stature, her skill sets. So they're always going to have to find someone like 5 foot that can puppet, that can also play the Girl Scout.
And
like,
play Lydia.
And understudy.
Yeah. Cover Lydia. It's really awfully specific at this point. But yeah. I'm sure, as there always is, 50 more people out there who could do it. But
actually don't know what they're going to do when it's time to replace, because everybody in our ensemble and cast is so specific. Mm-hmm. I tell my students all the time, like, you could walk in and sound great, but if you can't fit inside of this box, like, the job is not for you, you know?
Yeah.
That's fun. What do you teach?
Oh, you know, master classes. Yeah. I usually teach with a couple of other corporations that do theater arts education, usually.
But you just always say, make sure you get muscular, but not too muscular, because you got to fit in a box.
Yeah. So many kids take it so personally not getting parts, not getting jobs. I'm like, it's not about your talent. I'm like, you
it's
could again
so
be
rarely.
So amazing, but if you can't fit in a box, you know?
Like, yeah. And I think people also don't like to acknowledge luck. Because it feels like it diminishes your abilities. But there's so much luck involved in this. Like, I always say it's such a miracle when you get a job, because so many people in the room have to say yes and agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I always try to, like, step away from it and just do my best and then go away. It's harder sometimes than others. But
Yeah, there's a lot of stories that I hear from people on this podcast specifically that are just – they've gotten the roles when they don't care. If that makes sense.
That usually happens, I feel like.
Sure.
Yeah. Like you go in, you're like, I'm just going to do my thing. You make your choices, you leave, and then that's what you get. But the ones you really, really want, that's the ones that you don't get because you're not being authentic, I guess.
Well, I think there's a certain kind of like, some may say aloofness, but there's a certain kind of like confidence and when you're being cast in a show, it's – Broadway shows cost millions and millions of dollars. So these people are trusting you with millions of dollars on your back. And if you have a nervous energy or like you have like a kind of desperate energy for something, then that does not give the people confidence to put their money on you.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, they're investing. It's part of what they're putting together, and they want to trust you, and they want to make sure that like when you have to learn a new number and a new dance in one day and do it that night, that you're not going to be a nervous wreck, that you're going to be
that you
calm,
can deliver
calm, cool, and collected. So that ease, I think, is what kind of that comes from, is like, right, the not caring. It just comes off as an ease, a comfort, and a confidence.
Yeah, especially when it's a new show, because a new show, mm-hmm, you're really investing. You're going to be spending a long time with this group, mm-hmm, of people.
Right.
And I will say this group is one of the most well put together,
mild-mannered groups of energy.
Yeah, yes. Like everyone, I would describe it as a lot of people who take their job seriously, but no one takes themselves too seriously, is a really good balance, because everyone does the work and shows up and gives 100% every day, but also we all laugh at ourselves a lot, and nobody takes themselves very seriously.
It's also the nature of our show too. Like, it's so wacky, it's so crazy. You have to have a light spirit, and I think to bring that to work and just kind of, you know, take yourself out of it, makes it more fun.
What is a show about death?
Yeah, it is.
It's a literal show about death.
Yes.
It seems like to continue to, what am I trying to say? In order to maintain the energy and the levity of everything, you have to be very serious. But if you get too serious, then it, you know, it's not fun anymore.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you look at the show itself. It's these serious things that people deal with all the time. Loss. Feeling stuck in your life, you know, relationships, like being stuck, all these different things. And it's done with crude humor and inappropriate jokes and things that, like, a lot of us use to deal with those things in real life.
Yeah.
So if you're taking yourself too seriously, then you're not actually in the kind of environment of the show. And I think that's a lot of what they did in, like, putting this cast together, like, so painstakingly for years. If people didn't, you know, if that's why the cast changed so much, I think, from the beginning of development to where we are now, is it they really cared about putting the right kind of people in the building.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it's wild because all of us are also so different too. So to have so many different types of energies and people in one space that kind of work magic is pretty awesome. And I don't know how they did it, but
and also you guys are incredibly skilled. Like, as someone on the outside who is not part of the greater dance ensemble, what all of you are doing is so insane.
Oh yeah.
It is so crazy.
Yeah.
And truly so unique. Yeah, it's what you were saying before, Ramon, that I don't know how they're going to replace any of you, because I've never done a show, I can honestly say, with dancers who are also brilliant actors and comedians and physical comedians. It's like they're clowns, and you can't, I watch someone different every day, because everyone's doing such amazing and really layered work in ensemble dance numbers, which is not always, I don't think that's the norm.
Yeah. Right. Well, where did your dance background come from? Like, tell me about your beginnings. Like, you grew up, I think, in the Midwest, Elliot.
Kind of, yeah. Kentucky. Kentucky is like a weird, like, Midwest Southern hybrid. Like, geographically, it's the Midwest, but I would say, like, the mindset is very much Southern there. So I feel like culturally it's very Southern. But I started dancing when I was, like, I think in third grade is when I took my first dance class. And then just kind of, like, got the hang of it really quick, figured it out, and dove in deep right away. So late, I think, for some people start when they're, like, so young. But I kind of started at that sweet spot where I was, like, I knew kind of, like, what was going on. I didn't, like, waste any time with, like, tinker toe, like, just, like, keep your kids busy for an hour, you know? but I danced all through, you know, elementary, middle school, high school, and then had a lot of great dance training in college as well.
I grew up in the South too, and it was frowned upon to do things in the arts.
Sure, yeah. I mean, definitely less opportunity there. I had to, like, research, like, I had to go to the opportunities. Like, it wasn't easy. Like, I had to drive. It was like a half an hour to the dance studio and an hour to the performing arts school, and all those kind of things were far away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes you also, like, decide if you want to take them seriously, because it's a lot of extra time and money. I grew up in a small town where people either didn't get it or they were fully supportive. So I was lucky to have both ends of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for everyone that didn't get it, there were people that were seeing every recital I ever did and showing their support, and still do to this day. So You just gotta.
Do you have any siblings?
I do. I have an older brother and a younger sister.
And they, so you're right in the middle.
Right in the middle.
Were they supportive? Were your parents were like, oh, I gotta do another hour drive, or they were cool?
My parents were completely and insanely supportive. Like, they were, I don't know what possessed them to be as supportive as they were, but you know, my dad would wake up and take me to carpool at 6:30 before he went to work. I mean, it was wild, how supportive they were. But I mean, the proof is in the pudding. I because of that gained a lot of skill and work ethic early on, because of their support. Allowing me to gain that work ethic was due to them.
Cool. And Ramon, do you have a similar story?
No, actually. Yeah. I grew up in Los Angeles, born and raised. So I started doing theater in middle school. I was like, let me join the drama club. I did Hello Dolly, was our spring musical that year.
Ramon loves Hello Dolly.
Favorite show ever. I literally quote Dolly Levi like every day.
Are you going to go see Carrie Lee? Huh? You going to go see Carrie Lee in the tour?
I probably won't be able to see her, but I love her, and I'm sure she's fabulous. But yeah, I just did the shows in middle school. In my middle school, we would go see shows at a high school, performing arts high school. In West LA, Hamilton High School, where I ended up going, actually. They had a really great music academy. And I was there for the musical theater program, but you could choose so many other electives. So I ended up doing dance because I didn't want to take PE. Yeah. And I knew that dance would help me like get better parts in the shows. So I ended up doing dance and choir and everything else, really. Yeah, and it was pretty intense because our dance teacher at my high school was headmaster at Debbie Allen Dance Academy. So a lot of those students would come train at our high school. It was a public high school, like performing arts high school. So it was pretty intense. And then from there, I applied to college and got into school for theater. Had really intense dance training there where I took my first ballet classes, actually. And I guess the rest is history.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Well, that's interesting. I guess on the West Coast, obviously being in the arts is a little more accepted.
Yeah.
I think I would be in a much different place if I was a kid that grew up on the West Coast instead like in the South. Because I fell prey to the stigma of like, well, he's dancing. He's
right.
You know, yeah,
right?
Sure.
Because I love to sing and dance and all that. Mm-hmm. And then the pressure, the social pressure I got just made me go a different path.
It was so wild because my family, like my parents are from South Central LA and Compton. So it was definitely something that was totally alien to my parents. Like, what is he doing? You know, I'm sure they would talk in bed at night like, what is he doing? Like, what is this? You know, like, I'm in my room singing like 7.5 cents.
Oh my God.
Like, you know, so like my family, my church, it was something that was not understood by them at all. But walking into my high school, the first day of school, literally, I saw like a white guy with dreadlocks, a black guy with a huge mohawk, like girls making out, boys holding hands. I was 14 years old and I was like, where am I? Like, it was like a dream come true of like
fame.
And it was just like that, quite honestly. So I was so embraced at school and I found like a safe haven in performing arts in that school. Mm-hmm. Though my school is about an hour away, you know, I like lied and used someone's address and rode the school bus into the city every day. And it kind of worked out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And even so, like going to the better dance studios, they were like deeper in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. When my friends learned how to drive, my parents were really, I've got five siblings, mind you. So my mom was really good with like giving my friend $20 for gas money, you know.
I love it.
And
they'd
take
go
me
mom.
To class. Like seriously, she like was dealing with everyone else and, you know, she was soccer mom. So yeah, she was really good with just like, who can take you to class? Great, great. Mm-hmm. Here's $20. Thank you so much. You know.
Oh, that's awesome. That's all. Are you older or younger in the line?
I'm on the older side of the spectrum. Yeah. I'm number two of six.
Right.
So wow. My youngest sibling right now is 15 and my older brother is about 17 months older than I am.
And how old are you now?
30.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a big spread.
No, it's a very large spread. My parents are retiring soon and, you know, they've
still
only got two
teenager.
More kids in the house. Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Mom and dad.
I know.
That's fun. Dana, what about you? Like, I'm curious too, like where you got into puppetry as well, but when did you start?
Oh, so I grew up in Detroit, well, a suburb of Detroit, and I think I just had a ton of energy. And it's honestly one of those classic stories of we were at a birthday party and a friend said, I'm going to audition for The King and I at the Jewish Community Center. You know, that classic story. Uh-huh. And offensively, I thought, I can be in The King and I. And I went to the audition and my mom said she had no idea what I was going to sing. And I said, don't worry, I've got this. And I walked in and I did an entire choreographed routine to part of Your World from The Little Mermaid. And I booked it. And I was Princess Ying Yaoluk, which is honestly, like, I'm telling the story and I recognize how offensive this is, but we were in a different time.
We didn't know. We didn't know.
We didn't know.
No.
We didn't know. And I remember like bowing the first time and I came off stage and I said like, did you hear them clapping for me? And my mom was like, I don't think that was just for you.
Hilarious.
But take that in. And then I just kind of never stopped. And eventually I found my way to a theater camp called Stage Door Manor in the Catskills that I begged my parents to let me go to. And I remember like Ramon walking into high school. It was the first time I walked into a place where everybody was singing show tunes and everyone was so insanely gifted. And I had never heard other people sing like that, truly. And to be around kindred spirits like that just sort of made me even more passionate about it. And any thought that I had that I wasn't going to do it was sort of put away. And I just knew that's kind of how I was going to find my way. And then I went to NYU. And I actually, the puppetry thing came as a learned skill when I got cast in Avenue Q. It was not something I had learned previously, but I guess just had a slight affinity towards. I still would never call myself a true puppeteer in the way that I've seen many, many people. Rob McClure, for example, who was in our cast, played Princeton and also Trekkie, actually, another point. And he is an excellent, excellent puppeteer. Mm-hmm. It's watching him. When you see a real puppeteer do it, you're like, oh, okay, that's not something I do. But I do possess a skill set, I suppose.
Oh, that's fun. Yeah, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I guess I forgot that Rob was in Avenue Q as well. Yeah. And so speaking of Rob, you were saying he's the only one so far that's left the cast, right?
Uh-huh, so far,
And he went on to do Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yes.
So very exciting.
Good for him. Like, how close are all of you backstage, and are you friends outside of the stage and all that?
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of that came from when we went out of town to DC, and we really were there and with each other all the time, working on this thing, either rehearsing or, you know, when you're out of town with the show, you make that your community with that show strengthens because you don't have your normal, like your normal support group, your normal home base. So we really all like connected, I think, on a deeper level in DC, but also it's just kind of clicked.
Yeah. It's a really easy group of people and building something is really intimate.
Yeah.
And you are sort of asked to trust each other in a very specific way very quickly because, like Elliot was speaking of before, there are numbers we spent redoing, and we'd put it up that night and then we'd cut something and move it around. And a lot of it, you know, for example, in one of the numbers, The Netherworld, which got changed many times. Inside a box and I have no peripheral vision and I'm very close to the edge of the stage. So it's truly a trust exercise knowing that people are going to watch out for me and not you know, bump into me. But I think we all kind of trusted each other. So everything worked out really, really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And good people there. Again, there are so many good, like, spirits in the building. Mm-hmm. And it makes, it just makes it fun. And it makes a huge difference. It only takes one bad egg to, like, stir up a tornado.
Yes,
you know,
true.
Like,
yes, totally.
In a theater, we spend so many hours there. And we work so closely together that I don't know how they manage to gather all these wonderful individuals for this show.
A lot of luck. But
truly.
Yeah. Have you seen the movie, the Beetlejuice movie, before?
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
I only watched it when I was auditioning for it.
Same. Really?
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, because I didn't grow up on it. We didn't really like do, my family didn't really like do movies, if that makes sense. Like, we didn't really like watch movies.
Yeah.
And like, if I grew up on movies, I grew up on like either Disney movies or literally MGM musicals. Like, that's it. Like, that's all I watched. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really grow up watching Beetlejuice. And so I watched it kind of to get a sense of it. And I was like, this is weird.
I did watch the cartoon growing up. Like, there was a cartoon for a hot second. I remember more of that than the actual movie. Mm-hmm. And I think it would come on Saturday mornings. But my brother and I would watch the cartoon. And I watched the movie literally like a week before rehearsal started. I was like, let me just see what I'm about to get myself into.
You already signed your contract.
Yeah.
So you didn't use it for like audition material?
No. No. The material I got was definitely a lot different.
Very different.
Yeah.
Also, I think our show is like inspired by you know, the movie and a little bit the comic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I don't think it's a direct.
No.
Yeah. No, it's totally reimagined.
Yeah, it's totally reimagined in a really positive way. In the way I think a movie should be taken to the stage.
Yeah. I like to describe it as like if Beetlejuice were writing his own star vehicle musical.
Yeah.
It's very that. Like, it's not just like putting the movie on stage because like nothing really happens in the movie.
Nothing really happens.
It's very like, atmospheric and not very plot driven.
No, and Beetlejuice is in it for about 15 minutes.
Nothing.
Yeah.
So.
And they gave it so much heart too, which I love about the show.
Yeah, and this I mean, your show is more following Lydia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah,
like, which is unusual for the cartoon or the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's strange and unusual, you might say. Yeah.
I know. I was wondering how many like puns and references. We like, he said earlier. He's like, "There's so many good spirits in the show." I was like, "Yeah, but
we love a good spirit."
Yeah,
both meta and literal. Yes.
I was reading an article the other day saying that the cast of Beetlejuice is destroying TikTok.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
I mean, Dana, do you want to touch on this? You are. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You're so many of them.
You are the window into Presley Bryan, the myth, the legend.
Absolutely. So Presley and I spend a lot of time together. She's like my little sister because we both cover Lydia. So we spend understudy rehearsal time together and also – I just adore her. I just think she is the most lovely child. And
well, and in DC, you were together a lot in the vocal booth.
Yes, we were. That's really where it grew. Is in DC.
They even dress alike sometimes too. Like by not, yeah,
not unironically.
Yeah. Unironically, we sometimes wear the same thing. Which I'm not sure what that says about me. but she's just really great, and I'm the oldest of four siblings, so my natural instinct is to like mother and like take someone under my wing. And she was there with just basically, you know, a guardian, and her parents were so great, and they were like, "Oh, it's so sweet that you guys look out for her," and she's just lovely. And she's introduced us in exchange for our guardianship to many things on social media and the internet that we did not know about. So she was like, "You guys, there's this really cool new app. It's called TikTok. We're going to take it over." And I said, "I don't know what you mean." She's like, "No, it's really cool. People are doing like Beetlejuice numbers on there. Like a lot of people are singing Girl Scout and a lot of people are doing Dead Mom and Say My Name." So she showed us these videos and she said, "Oh, you should join." And I was like, "I don't think I can join any more apps. Yeah. Like this is, but I will participate in anything that you want me to do." So we have these like 3 minutes in the vocal booth where it's Alex Brightman and Jill Abramovitz and Presley and I. And we let Presley pick whatever TikTok she wants, and she has 2 minutes to teach it to us, and then we just film it. And whatever happens, happens. And she started uploading them, and like little by little, I think as the cast album came out and the more popular that became and the show sort of started taking off, the more viewers we got. And all of a sudden, Presley had like 200,000 followers on TikTok.
Well, when she went on for Lydia, she did one with Alex Brightman.
And it has 3 million views.
Yeah, I saw that one. Yeah.
And the thing that's cool about it is that it's just getting more and more people kind of interested in the show just because it's like people are interested in it and know about it even if they're not theater people because of like certain like face filters that you can like switch to a crazy clown to yourself, and people do that to say my name because it like is cool and works with the filter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like another like random weird like cult.
Yeah,
thing.
It's like finding a whole separate audience that I don't think we ever thought of.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's so funny because I think people talk about how our show sort of like took a slow climb and we were like chugging up this mountain, and we all loved the show and believed in the show, and everyone who came to the show loved the show, but I think we were like fighting a little bit to share it with the world and convince people to come. And I think that for some reason we underestimate the power of social media. And with our show especially, we have a girl at the center who's a teenager, and I think that has drawn a whole different audience. And then all of us are pretty accessible when people send us messages. Like I always try to respond or like it. And I think people really underestimate how that's going to affect and continue to affect different shows and ticket sales. And I think we've only seen an upward trend of how powerful that will be.
I mean, a big theme in the show is feeling invisible, feeling like no one can see you. And part of the social media phenomenon that's happening around musical theater is that you can find your tribe just like you walk into high school or like you walk into Stage Door Manor. You can find people that you connect with on just something as simple as a show.
Yeah.
And you can make an entire community based on this thing, which is like something really incredible. And I'm still wrapping my mind around as a millennial.
Yeah.
Same. Yeah. As someone who's out of that age bracket, like the people that come to the Stage Door dressed up and they're like, we met on Instagram. We love the show. And this girl dressed up as Lydia and their friend who they met in Wisconsin dressed as Beetlejuice, and someone else dressed up as the Girl Scout, and they all met at the show and agreed to come to the city and like saved up so they could see the show together cosplay together.
Like really incredible.
Yeah. And the cosplay thing too, I think has also been a whole separate entity. And I'm really excited about Broadway Con because I feel like that's where we're really going to hit our stride.
There are so many things in life that stress me out. You know what shouldn't stress me out? Eating. So we can all eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So you can choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options for all dietary needs. And you can discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and even some drinks to help you stay fueled up. Factor is also celebrating Earth Day all month long. So look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for our lowest carbon footprint meals. Say that 5 times fast. Earth Month Eats. Earth Month Eats. Just remember, these no fuss, no mess meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, and cleaning up. So just simply heat and eat the good stuff. Head to factormeals.com/TTP50 and use code TTP50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code TTP50 at factormeals.com/TTP50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. So what are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up your springtime goals.
That is great. Yeah, I got to start putting my costume together for Broadway Con.
Are you going to be the shrunken head?
I should. Well, I just need to stand on Dana's shoulders.
Yeah,
absolutely. I can do it. Yeah.
You guys could do like an Olsen twins.
Yes, I'm very strong. Like I've got this. Yeah.
I'll just be a box.
There was a whole song about a box.
There was.
One point in Beetlejuice, so... songs.
Yeah.
How much got changed?
Everything.
Everything.
Well, this was a softball question. I know the answer to it. Because I talking with Alex Timbers, we talked about the reviews, the mixed reviews that came out of DC.
Yes.
And people
highs
either,
and lows.
Yeah, people either loved it or hate it. And the show almost got completely reworked from top to bottom. Mm-hmm. And you know, he was saying too that like even the character of Beetlejuice was a little bit too much, and they brought him back and they gave him some heart. And I mean, talk about your own. I mean, if you had any like sort of the stress and anxiety of going through that that time,
plenty. well, so I don't think this is really any secret. Like, one of the biggest changes that affected us as the ensemble was the changing of the Netherworld. So yeah. In DC, it was essentially it was a boy band that their like sentence in the Netherworld was to welcome people to the Netherworld and explain kind of the rules, how everything worked. And it was a lot of fun to do. It's like a very fun number. Like, and that had been one thing that had not changed since I started. It was always that, and it always like got a huge response. People loved it. And same in DC, it seems like people were really responding to it. And then we did early rehearsals in January where they were like, we're going to try something different with the Netherworld. And it kind of like completely got scrapped. And there was a completely different concept, new number that was challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was challenging. Number one, it was to be completely honest, it was a bit of an ego hit.
Were you in the boy band?
For me. I was in the boy band. Me and Ramon were in the boy band.
That's why the male ensemble was so heavy, too. It was like five.
Because there were five guys that had to carry this
like
boy
major
member.
Singing. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was, you know, as those things always are, like if you have like a nice, like little like feature, a fun thing to do, and it gets taken away, that's like, you know, kind of a bummer. And then it just, the new number had to face a lot of challenges, either foreseen or unforeseen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a big test in my patience.
Yeah, just kind of
to really
that
practice.
Yeah,
kind of like trusting that they know what's best for the show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And being willing to like be along for the ride, even if I am upset and stressed and all that stuff.
I mean, was there ever any point when you guys are like, This isn't gonna work.
Oh,
yeah. It's one of those things where like we all are artists as well. We all like have seen shows. We kind of know like how a show is gonna do based off of our own experiences.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, I don't know about this. But again, it's one of those things where you're like, I'm just
we're
here
like, we trust,
to do what
yeah.
you ask
yeah.
me to do.
We're the conduit for
your vision,
work.
You know.
Yes, and I think that we were. You know, there were times where we got to voice our concerns. There were times where we just had to kind of stand back and be quiet and rehearse and do our thing. There's a lot of rehearsing in the lobby, figuring it out, making it happen. And I think that it was also something too, where like in the rehearsal room, we're in our normal clothes with no set, no lights, no any of the spectacle. And for something like the Netherworld, it really took what we were doing upstairs in like fluorescent light, like with the carpeting, to like a completely different level that none of us really
could
see.
We were blind to it at that point.
Yeah.
I think.
So I think it really is a testament to the our creatives and our producers for really like sticking to their guns on that and just trusting and a lesson to me to try and always trust that everyone has the best interest of the show at heart.
It was also one of those things where they were figuring it out as we were doing it.
Yeah.
So whereas we had questions to justify certain things that we were doing, they didn't have answers yet. They're like, just figure it out and go for it, you know? So that was pretty difficult trying to figure something out that wasn't a complete idea, if you will.
Yeah.
But just making it work because, you know, I'm here in the space and that's
our job.
To try to, you know, make it
and
work.
And I think anybody who does a new Broadway musical knows that the code for the upper lobby means you're completely reworking a number and nobody wants to go to the upper lobby. So it's like going to the principal's office.
Yeah.
So
it's
like
awful,
when they're like, ensemble, you'll be in the upper lobby with Connor or we're like, so our joke, like it kind of became this running joke where we'd be like, you'll be in the Netherworld forever, which is like one of Juno's lines. But ultimately I think we do all trust each other and we trusted and had faith in our creative team. But there were days where like you're under this lighting and you're upstairs and it's dim and you're like, I think I can't absorb anymore.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I want to bang my head against a wall a little bit because I feel like we've been working on this one count of eight for 4.5 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what has actually changed?
And then you're like, wait, what happened?
And then like before you do it, you're like, am I doing the same thing I was doing? Yeah. I'm confused. Yeah. Are we on version A or C?
Yeah.
I was also doing Whole30 at the time. So I couldn't drink and I don't recommend recommend that. I don't recommend making a new musical without a vice.
No. But I think every new musical goes through this, and everybody has that. Oh, yeah. There's always one number or one thing. Yeah. And what's interesting is I think it's normally the opening of Act 1 and the opening of Act 2, and those were never things that were a problem.
No.
So it was just we had this one thing, but I think ultimately we got to a place that is very, very successful.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
It is the middle of Act 2 also, so it kind of gets you over the hump of Act 2 and to the end of the show. So I do understand that.
Yeah.
I just want to stress for the people listening that, I mean, when you're teching a show or when you're working a show or whatever, you're performing at night, but what you've rehearsed that day could be completely different. So you're like you said, version B, right?
Yeah.
So
that's previews.
So you're doing version B rehearsing during the day, but you're doing A again at night, and then you have to do B the next night, but then rehearse for C the following morning.
It has to get teched also, you have to remember, before it goes on stage. So you're doing version A at night. You're rehearsing version B
the next
in the lobby, but it's not going in until the day
after you tech
You tech it. So like sometimes you have two different versions or three different versions, and you're not super sure which one's going on stage that evening.
Right. You know, and there was a moment when we were doing Creepy Old Guy. There was a dance break that got new music, and we learned new choreography for this dance, but I don't think the music was ready yet. And the information got passed to the ensemble that we were doing a certain version of the number.
That we were doing the old version.
Yeah, but the information didn't get passed to the orchestra. So literally, they're playing
a shortened version
of this dance break that we worked on earlier that we weren't doing that night. So literally, we're like dancing. It's different music. It's maybe about four bars cut, and everyone just
we all just kind
crazy.
Of ran, and we're and we're supposed. It gave us like an eight count to where we were supposed to just freeze.
Yeah.
So everyone just like stopped and ran and tried their best to freeze on their number, but
like
that was wild.
Someone got stuck center stage, like next to Beetlejuice, like in a spotlight. It was just madness. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's like it's also what makes it really
those are
fun.
The best. Yeah.
You know, because those are the things you remember, and you can, at the time it doesn't seem as funny, but like 10 minutes later, it's the funniest thing that's ever happened to you.
Yeah. Well, it helps get through previews when those kind of moments happen, because it just like is like a catharsis of laughter and fun, and that we again don't take ourselves too seriously. Yeah. We're making a musical at the end of the day. No one's gonna die. Yeah.
And there are days you're out there and you're saying lyrics and you're like, are these lyrics?
Yeah.
Is this the one I'm supposed to say today?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Also, we were wearing skeleton masks, so you couldn't
Everyone's
see our
just
faces
laughing.
Like losing it.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to part one of this bonus episode with Elliot Maddox, Ramon Owens, and Dana Steingold from the Beetlejuice Ensemble. Stay tuned.
Take a deep breath, make the world a little colorful.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.